texts StopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. KPFT Houston.
Tantalizing beat of Clouds Below Your Knees by Ray Lynch. That means it's 8 p.m. on a Thursday and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to stories and the art of telling them, right here on KPFT Houston. Well, I'm your guest host this evening, Eric Heen, and I'm backed up by the talented team of Drs. Hank Rubicek, Warren Holloman, and Mary Edgerton, as well as Greg Audell, and our media maven, Tatiana Gago, as well as our guest hosts, Harwood Taylor and Chris Gorman. And here we celebrate the power of story. We do this by placing the spotlight on guests who will take us on magical journeys before landing us safely back into the present. Well, stories can be very entertaining, but they serve purposes that go far beyond mere entertainment. And one of these purposes is to bring people together and form connections between us. And that's what our special guest tonight does so well with his stories. His name is Joel Ben Izzy. You're going to like this guy. In 1983, Joel Ben Izzy graduated from Stanford. Then he set off to travel the world gathering and telling stories in some 36 countries on five continents, in venues ranging from amphitheaters in Italy to the Tokyo Jewish Community Center, and from the streets of Paris to a bomb shelter in Jerusalem. Those of us at So What's Your Story came to know him through his amazing memoir, The Beggar King and the Secret of Happiness, a personal favorite of Dr. Hank's, and he'll be referring to it later in the show. Joel's second book, Dreidels on the Brain, which came out from Dial Books in 2016, is a young adult coming-of-age Hanukkah novel. It might be the only one in existence. It was chosen as a finalist for the National Jewish Book Award. I read that book, and I highly recommend it. Joel has also recorded and produced six CDs, and he's receiving rewards from the American Library Association, Parents' Choice Foundation, and others. And you can get his books and CDs and watch his videos on his website at storypage.com. One word, storypage.com. Now, he's also one of our nation's leading story coaches, with clients ranging from the Federal Reserve to Pixar. I'm pleased to welcome Joel Ben Izzy to So What's Your Story and tap into ways stories can help us connect. Joel, it's quite
a
resume.
Hey, Eric, how are you?
Good. Thanks for being our guest here.
Hi, Joel. I'm Hank, and I'm sitting right next to Eric because I don't want to miss it.
Hey, Hank. Glad to meet you both, and thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, thank you.
Yes, thank you, Joel. Now, our theme tonight is on how stories make connections and bring people together. And your stories are designed to make multiple connections. How do you manage to compile stories with such a great range?
You know, I guess it's as they say, one story leads to another. Mm-hmm. You sort of tell a story, and it's kind of like a guitar. If you pluck a string on one guitar, that same string will vibrate on another guitar.
Ah.
And then people, it sort of brings out those stories. And then you find that, I don't know, the other strings around start vibrating, and suddenly you've got a story session and a concert all in one.
Hmm. Okay, now your first story here is called The Lost Horse, and it teaches us a timeless lesson. Let's hear that story.
All right. It's a story. And, you know, this is it's an ancient story, but it is a true story. I don't know if it happened, but I know that it's true.
Huh.
The story comes from China long ago. And far to the north of China, on the edge of the Gobi Desert, they say there was a man who had a really, truly magnificent horse. People would come from miles around just to admire this horse. And just they'd stare at it and they'd say, "You're truly blessed to own such a horse." And the man said, "Who knows? What seems like a blessing may be a curse." They said, how can you say that? This horse? Well, one day this horse runs off. It just jumps the fence. It's gone, not a trace. And people come by to look at the empty corral and say, "Oh, it's a curse." He says, "Who knows? What seems like a curse may be a blessing." They said, "But he's gone." Not long after that there's sort of a cloud on the desert, and that horse comes galloping back across. They can see the cloud of dust, but the horse is not alone. It is followed by 21 wild horses, and every one of them is as magnificent as the one that had run off. And people come to admire them, and they look, and they say, You're right. It was a blessing." He said, "Who knows? What seems like a blessing may be a curse." They said, "How can you say that? You're rich, because by the law of the land, all these horses suddenly belonged to him. He had his own horse and 21 magnificent wild horses." Well, one day his son, his only son, whom he loved dearly, was riding one of the wild horses. He was thrown from it and broke his leg. And there he was in pain, and as he sat there recovering, people came and said, "You know what? You're right. It's a curse. It's a curse. Look at your son there in pain." And the man said, "Who knows? What seems like a curse may be a blessing." They said, "How can you say that? Look at your son." It was not long after that the emperor came through that village and drafted every able-bodied young man from that village to fight in the war. It was a horrible war against the people to the north, and it was fought for the emperor's own greed. And every young man from that village, every able-bodied young man from that village who went to that war was killed. And only this man's son survived, and over time that broken leg healed. And so to this day in that village, they say, what seems like a blessing may be a curse. What seems like a curse may be a blessing.
Ah. Great story, Joel.
Very, thank very you. Timeless. Yeah, very, very timeless as well.
Now, Joel, I understand that story is timeless, but it also has, it applies to your own life, you told us.
It does, very much. You know, that is the first chapter in my book, The Beggar King and the Secret of Happiness. It's called The Lost Horse. Every chapter opens with a folk tale somewhere around the world that sort of captures the theme of what happens in the story that runs through there. And I said it before I told that. I know it's a true story, whether it happened or not, that what seems like a blessing may be a curse. What seems like a curse may be a blessing. This was a story I told as a storyteller, and I told it a lot and kind of thought I owned this story. This, to me, was my emblematic story. I would put on my hat and tell my story, and I thought, this is I got it rigged. I thought, because I can turn any curse into a blessing by how I tell the story. I thought, that's a good system. That's why this is such a good job for me to have. Because if something good happens, that's good. If something bad happens, well, I can turn it into a good story. And I thought what I had found was the secret of happiness. And I was thinking that one day when I was watching my kids rake up a bunch of leaves in the yard, and I thought, wow, now I'm perfectly happy. And I even said out loud, I said, I'm perfectly happy, and I plan to be happy for a long time. And, of course, there's an old Jewish saying that says, people make plans and God laughs. And it was the very next day God chose to laugh. It was actually the holiday of Purim. Purim is that classic Jewish holiday where, I don't know, where there's a complicated, involved
twisted story of an evil guy who wants to kill off all the Jews but doesn't realize the queen is Jewish, and suddenly it all works out in the end with a lot of twists and a lot of misery in the middle. And it's a classic Jewish story, and it boils down to they tried to kill us, they failed, let's eat.
Right. Yeah. And that's also Eric and the rest of you. It's a very long story. That's why we say things like, "I don't want to hear the whole Megillah."
That's right. The whole Megillah and Megillah Gorilla. I grew up with as a kid. So, anyways, people make plans and God laughs. And it was the next day, as I awoke, that God decided to laugh, because I woke with this with gout in my foot. I didn't know it was gout. It was just I knew my toe was the size of a tomato, and it looked like it was going to explode. My wife said, "Joel, your toe is going to explode." I said, "No, this is nothing. I'm fine. This is I can." She said, "How can you perform?" I had 3 gigs that day. I said, "I'm fine. I'll do like Hillel. I can tell stories standing on one foot." Hillel explained the whole Torah standing on one foot. Don't do something to others you don't want them to do unto you. The rest is commentary. And so I quite happily went off to my gig, but we did end up making an appointment with the doctor, and they did fax over a prescription for this. And when I finally got to the doctor, the gout was all gone. And he said, "Well, let me examine you." And I said, "No, you're the doctor. You examine me." And he began to feel my neck. I said, "Doctor, that's not my toe. That's my neck." He said, "I know. I'm an endocrinologist. Necks are my specialty, so I always like to examine people's necks." To which I said, "Good thing you're not a proctologist, because where would that put us?" And he said, "You have a little bump in your neck." I said, "Doctor, I have a lot of little bumps in my neck. That's what a neck is, bump, 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 bump." He said, "No, you have a bump that shouldn't be here." I said, "Doctor, I shouldn't be here." I stopped making jokes when he brought out a needle. And if you were watching on the radio, I could show you. It was this long. I said, "Well, doctor, why the weapon?" He said, "Look, you're young and healthy. Chances that this was anything to worry about are 1 in 1,000. Still, I'd like to test it to be on the safe side." Now, I think we've all heard variations of this story. And variations of this story go round and around, and they end up with a word that starts with the letter C that we don't like to hear. But I tried to convince my wife this was a good cancer. I said, "No, this is thyroid cancer. It's going to make a great story. I'll tell about the needle. This will be fantastic." She wasn't buying that at all. This was cancer. I was going into surgery. And I said, "These were my last words." They said, "No, Tyler, this will make a great, great horse, a great, great, great story, like the lost horse story, a cursed blessing." And that was pretty much the last thing I said. And when I woke up from surgery, there was something strange. I felt as though I was dreaming. And it's like that when you wake up from surgery anyways. But in my case, I felt as though I was dreaming, and I said, "Wow, this is a strange adventure." But what came out was, and I tried it again, and I said, and nothing came out. I thought, "Oh, this must be a dream, one of those dreams that storytellers have where you get up on stage, you can't speak, or you get up on stage and forgot to get dressed." But it wasn't a dream at all. I sat there trying to speak again and again, and after a time, the sun rose, and I realized 2 things. One, I was wide awake, and 2, I could not speak. My horse was gone. And so when the doctor came, I said, doctor, wow. The doctor said, "I wouldn't worry. Nerves in shock. Could be a couple weeks, maybe a month." After a couple weeks, "Doctor, I still can't talk." He said, "It could be a month." And after a month, I said, "Doctor, I can't talk." He said, "It could be 2 months. I wouldn't worry." And after 2 months, I said, "Doctor, it's 2 months." He said, "Oh, if it's 2 months, this is permanent. You won't be able to speak again. I hope that doesn't affect your work." And that set me off on a journey, and that's a story I tell in the book, is the journey of coming to accept the fact that I never speak again, and to see it as a blessing.
Joel, hi, this is Hank. When I first read your book, I thought, this is my grandmother speaking to me. I really don't want to hear this again. Because everything, I lived with my grandparents and my parents in one house. You know, she and my mother were in Sudhof concentration camp. My grandfather was in Dachau. So everything she spoke about was in story form. Everything. I mean, everything was in story form. If I asked her what was for dinner, she'd sit me down and say, "Let me tell you about the little boy at the carnival." And I'm thinking, "The hell does it have to do with dinner?" And then 20 minutes later, the story was about, "Don't ever ask me what's for dinner again." Some years ago, I was going through a very deep depression, and there were a few reasons for it, but none were so overwhelming as my voice being all but gone. Mm. I became really angry with doctors who minimized my fear. You know, none of them even asked me what I did for a living. And when I told them that I was a communication presenter, a communication professor, public presenter, radio host, they looked at me with the astonishingly obnoxious lack of ownership for what they just said. There's no apologies, none expected, not from them. And then my mother sends me this book called The Beggar King and the Secret of Happiness. And she inscribed these words: "Dear Hank, these stories aren't medicine. They're better. Read about the author before the stories. Enjoy." And my mom was right. You know, my grandmother, as I was saying, said nothing unless it was in story form. And it always worked in getting my attention. So I figured, why not give it a try? After all, the book is small enough. But I also thought, you know, this guy's about my age, Jewish. How interesting can he be? But the interest came from the deep connection that I felt with you through your stories, your fear, your hope. First published by Algonquin in 2003, The Beggar King and the Secret of Happiness has been translated in 13 foreign languages, in 18 foreign editions, and is now in development as a musical. On its cover, it reads, the Dallas Morning News submits, "This brief book speaks to people in trouble. It provides edifying advice, intimately given, like the best-selling Tuesdays with Maury's." I use this book, Joel, in my storytelling class because I want students to feel how stories enter through the windows of their souls, and because it's also a damn fun book. So I just wanted to say to you, especially after listening to The Lost Horse, thank you.
Oh, well, Hank, thank you. That makes my day. And could you do me a favor and thank your mother for me?
I will. Too bad she's suffering from minor dementia right now. She doesn't remember a damn thing. I think she does it on purpose, though. It's like what my grandfather, when he was near death, true story, my grandmother was in the room with me. He was a man of very few words. He never said anything, really. And my grandmother says to him, "You know, Yonkel, I'm really sorry about anything that I ever said to you. I'm sorry about everything that happened during the Holocaust. I'm sorry about anything that I said to you after all of these years. I just want you to know I'm really sorry." And he looked at her. This is about 2 days before he died. And he said, "Don't worry about it. I never listened to you."
Yeah. This is funny. You know, sometimes you think we could just sell irony on the wholesale market.
Right.
You know, and we'd do quite well with it. But you know, writing a book is, I'm so used to traveling around the world telling stories and seeing different audiences. And of course, you always see your audience and get the immediate response. Mm-hmm. And writing a book is so different. It feels like putting a message in a bottle, mm-hmm. and a message that you write and rewrite and tear up and just shred it and say, "No, this is terrible. Right. Nobody's ever gonna..." And then finally, you find it and say, "Ah, all right. I'll put this one in the bottle." But then you toss it out to sea, and you sort of hope that someday someone will say, "Oh, I found your bottle."
Right. Eric is prompting me to shut up because he's got a show to do. Okay, Eric, go ahead.
In a subtle way.
You get a couple storytellers who are delighted just with the mere fact that we can speak, Eric.
I'm trying to squeeze a word in edgewise. Right. Hey, Joel, okay, your next story, it really underscores our theme we have tonight of making human connections. It's about a connection you made with someone while riding a city bus. Tell us that story.
All right, I will do that. And I'll mention, I think you mentioned your grandmother's in Dachau, and there was a Munich government program that brought me to Munich, a Zivil Courage program, talk about sort of people standing up for courage. And someone was making a documentary. They had me tell this story in Dachau, in one of the barracks there. Fascinating. But the story, no, it starts on a bus. And actually, I have been to Houston once in my life, and I remember two things about it. One is I remember the Blue Bonnet Bowl, which is which was very, very colorful. I played in the Blue Bonnet Bowl. In fact, and this must have been around 1980 something, maybe 79. And what I played was trombone. The Stanford band was there with the Stanford football team. We brought the team with us. I think we were pretty much banned from the bowl after what we did there on that field. So I remember that, and I remember the buses had strobe lights on them, which very much impressed me, because they would give sort of priority to the buses going along. And I thought how different that was from where I grew up. You're on the 10 freeway, more or less. Mm-hmm. If you take that 10 freeway west, 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 you get to sort of where I grew up. Not quite to Santa Monica, but you get to the east side of L.A., the suburbs of the suburbs. And where I grew up was a world that to me seemed just flat, square, endless freeways going off in all directions. There were mountains to the north, at least they told us there were, but when I was a kid it was so smoggy we couldn't see them. But we were told they were there, and we were boundaried by freeways all sides and streets all square and flat. And to me that was the world. And in L.A., when I was a kid growing up, cars were kind of sacred. Everybody wanted cars, and the kids would all talk about cars, but being a kid I didn't have a car, and to get anywhere I would have to take the bus. Not just the bus, but bus after bus. And I would sit on these buses, which were these long, slow-moving things, which when you come to a red light, you stop. When you come to a green light, you also stop, because there's someone getting on the bus, and by the time they get on the bus, the light is red, and you wait, and you sit there on the bus and look at the cars going past. Porsche, whoosh, Corvette, whoosh, Lamborghini, zoom, Alfa Romeo, zoom, Corvette, zoom, bus. It was such a long, slow process. I went to see a friend who lived on the other side of L.A. It took me 4 hours on three buses to get there. We had an hour together, and it took me 4 hours on three buses to get back. And I came home. I said, Mom, Dad, this is ridiculous. This bus took, I spent all day on this bus today. You have to buy me a car. And they said, Joel, that's out of the question. I said, why? Give me one good reason. They said, Joel, you're 12. You don't drive. And so I was stuck riding these buses, which were not only hot, but slow, and usually crowded except for when they were empty, but it was never good. Buses felt like this was a place to be for losers. And sometimes, just when I was a kid, to protest, when I was in a bad mood because I was stuck having to ride the bus, I would go and I would sit in the seat reserved for elderly and handicapped. Right? That's the kind of mood I was in. And that's what it was one day, this time of year, which was getting now, like close to Hanukkah. I was stuck going from point A to point B, through point C, around point Q, and we were going through the Jewish neighborhood in Los Angeles, the Fairfax neighborhood. And the bus is lumbering along. I'm sitting in the seat reserved for elderly and handicapped, and I'm the only one on the bus, just chugging along, and we come to a green light, and what do?
You stop.
Of course we stop. And wait, and light goes from green to red, and then green again. What's taking so long? Outside is somebody trying to come on the bus, and he's walking with a shopping bag and a cane, one step up at a time. Slow as can be, and he comes to the driver with his shopping bag and his cane, and he says to him, he says, how much is it? The driver looks at him, figures him for a senior citizen. It's a quarter. 25 cents? Yeah, a quarter. He reaches into his pocket, takes out a coin, 5. Another coin, 10. Another coin, 11. That's it. I see my whole life passing before me. I'm going to live and die on this bus, stuck in front of the farmer's market in Fairfax District. Because finally, light goes from green to red, nickels and pennies. Mr. Elderly Handicap has paid his fare. And then without looking back, he just starts to back up to the seat where I'm sitting, because he figures that's going to be his seat. He doesn't even see me there. I scoot to the side by the window, and he sits down right next to me. We're the only two people on the bus, and he looks at me, and I can feel him looking at me. I'm looking out the window looking for, I don't know, maybe a Lamborghini or an Alfa Romeo or something. But as we look, I feel him staring at me, and after eventually I have to look at him. And he reaches in the bag and pulls something out and holds it up. It's an orange. And he says, "What do you think?" And I say, "I think it's an orange," which was an honest answer, but not a thorough answer. Well, a thorough answer would have been, I think it's an orange. I think you're a weirdo. Stay away from me. But he says, "Yes, it's an orange. And what do you think of it?" Well, I took the orange and I sort of rolled it in my hands. I looked around and I said, "Well, it's a little green on one side, but it's probably orange in the middle. It's navel, so it's seedless, but it's pretty much just an orange." And I gave it to him and I scooted closer over the window. And he looked at the orange for a long time, and we had a long time because that bus was going nowhere fast. And finally he said, you don't understand, do you?" And there was right, because I had not a clue as to what the heck he was talking about. And he said, "You know, I'm not from around here." Duh. Obviously, because people in L.A. don't actually talk to each other on the buses. He said, "I came here after the war." Do you know about the war? Now, when I was a kid, the war was pretty much the phrase you'd use for one particular war. I think we've had lots of wars since then, so you can't really say the war. But it was World War II. And yeah, I learned about it in school. We studied it. His eyes lit up. He said, "Ah, in school, when you learned about the war, did they tell you about the place where I spent the war?" I said, "I don't know. What was the place?" He said, "It was called Auschwitz." And they said, "Oh, yeah, I remember. My book, my history book, had one picture in it. It was the only place in the book where it said the word Jew, and I was the only Jew in my school. And it showed a picture of the gates of Auschwitz, and it had a sign that said, and he said, "Arbeit macht frei. Work will make you free." He said, "This picture, the book," he said, "did they tell you it was black and white?" I said, "Well, no, wait. The place was black and white, but the picture wasn't black and white." He said, "No, it was black and white." I said, no, the picture, the photograph, but the place was." He said, "It was black and white." He said, "The guards wore black uniforms, and the snow was white. It would fall one day, pure as could be. And the next day, the ashes from the smokestacks would turn it gray. The sky was gray, the fence was black, and the guards wore black boots so shiny I could see my face reflected, pale white, and my uniform black and white pressed paper." He said, "Everything was black, white." He said, "Look," and now he pulled up his shirt sleeve. He said, "You see these numbers? They're blue now, but when they burned them in, they were black." He said, "We would stand in a long line each day with a bowl, a black metal bowl. And when we got to the front, they would serve us our meal. It was soup, they said. It was maybe 7 or 8 potatoes cooked until they dissolved. It was gray, like dishwater. Everything black, white, or gray." He said, "When I had a free moment, I would wander near the fence if I could to look for paper. Paper to put in my clothes, to put in my shoes, to try to stay warm. And one day, against the gray snow, I saw a piece of newspaper. And I picked it up, and beneath it, the snow was perfectly white. And there, in the midst of that white snow, I saw something so beautiful. But I had to look at it, for you see, I had forgotten the color. When I realized what it was, an orange, I picked it up, hid it. I took it back to the barracks and hid it in a hole in the wall. He said, that night, while everyone slept, I took it out just to look at it. He said, you have to understand how hungry I was. I had eaten nothing but potato water for 6 months. I wanted to eat it like you would eat an apple, but I couldn't. It was too beautiful. So instead, I rolled it between my hands. And then I took my fingernail and I scratched at it, and I smelled. And what I smelled was not Auschwitz. I smelled the fields outside of Haifa in what was then called Palestine. For I had a cousin who had moved there before the war. He said, I live on a kibbutz. Here we grow oranges. The smell of orange blossoms fills the air. It's the smell of freedom. For that moment, with my eyes closed, smelling that orange, I was free. Hmm. Every night I woke up, every night I would smell it and put it back. I told myself I wouldn't eat it till after a very bad day, but in Auschwitz, you didn't have to wait long for a bad day. There came a selection. I saw many people killed. A man with a bayonet would point right to the barracks, left to the shower. He looked at me. I thought of this orange, and he pointed right to the barracks. That night, it was Hanukkah. I gathered those around me and said, I have something. No candles, no matches, but this. I brought out the orange, and I passed it around. And each one rolled it in their hands, and each one smelled it. When it came back to me, I peeled it and gave each one a section, careful not to spill a drop. I closed my eyes, and I ate mine. And I will tell you, nothing before or since has tasted so sweet. That was the taste of hope and of life and of freedom. Eventually, I was freed. The war ended, and I came here. But he said, you see that orange? It saved my life. Hmm. As he said that, the bus stopped. He got up and said, young man, always remember the sweet things in life. Hmm. He handed me the orange, got off the bus, and I never saw him again. But what I have is the story of an orange.
Wow.
That's remarkable.
That is. It's from your book, Vitals on the Brain, I recall.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, Joel, I know it's hard to answer this in about 30 seconds, but...
I can't say hello in 30 seconds.
I know, but let's try. But you said this story, the one about the orange here, is symbolic of how you got involved in storytelling to begin with. Could you, in about 30 seconds, tell us how about that?
Well, you know, hearing that story let me take what was happening in my own life and realize that the stories we tell can carry us to another world. Mm-hmm. And at this time, my father was sick, we were broke, I was miserable and mm-hmm. lonely, and I realized, you know, there's great, great power in that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, there certainly
Beautiful.
Is.
Beautiful.
Okay. Well, this is Eric Heen with Dr. Hank Rubicek and Tatiana Gago, and you're listening to So What's Your Story? With special guest storyteller Joel Ben Izzy. On KPFT Houston and 91.9 on the dial for our friends in Huntsville. Hey, Tatiana, what do you think of our stories tonight?
No, I had to wipe some tears off because I always get so emotional when I hear these types of stories. They're just so beautiful.
They are.
I don't know if you can tell right now from some of my voice.
You're fogging up the window there. So,
You're such a sap.
I'm so sensitive.
I'm the same way, Tatiana.
No, these are really
only
good
way
stories.
To be.
Bunch of softies here. Tatiana, you've read Joel's first book, The Beggar King.
A few years ago, I believe, when I was in Dr. Hank's class.
That's exactly right. And what's it like to have read that book, and now here you hear the author in spoken form?
You know, I think it's pretty awesome. And although I haven't actually met you in person, I feel like you're right here in the studio. I mean, there is one particular story that I do love, and it's the same one as Dr. Hank's. It's the cricket who jumped to the moon. I loved that story, and I think that it's really relatable for some of us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I love your dad's spirit, you know, because when you said in there, we make plans, but God laughs.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. That has to be my favorite line.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely.
Well, Tatiana, our theme is about making connections tonight. And so could you, in your usual erudite manner, give us some connections to some other storytelling venues in Houston?
King of Segway.
Yes.
Okay, very good.
Well, you know, let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild, because it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel. That's located at 1500 Sunset. The next swap is November 26th. 26, so do yourself a favor and make plans to attend, and also bring a friend. And be sure to visit the Guild's webpage at www.houstonstorytellers.org for information about all of their upcoming events, including Telebration, the National Day of Storytelling, this Saturday, November 23rd, at the Black Lab on Montrose. And don't worry about the price, because it's free. Just pay for your dinner. And while you're on the Guild's webpage, why not become a member? You can do it easily online. Also, listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008, all listed on the menu under radio program.
Gives you something to do, Joel, tonight. It'll take about 6-7 hours.
There you go.
I'm all over it.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And if you don't own a radio, that's not a problem, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and on Facebook Live. We're also on YouTube. I guess you can say we're all over the place, huh? And if you really want to catapult the storyteller in you, become a member of the Tejas Storytelling Association and the National Storytelling Network. Both are great supporters for our show. We'd also like you to suggest program ideas when visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page. And be sure to share it with your friends. And we'd love it if you like us when you leave. And if you got guests to suggest, maybe yourself, let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpft.org. And we promise to get back to you. And don't forget our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live, the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy some terrific stories. The next one is December 10th, and the theme is perfect for ushering in the holidays, and that is family.
Thank you, Tatiana, for filling us in on the storytelling world in Houston, like only you can do.
A lot going on there.
There is.
And I think you have a teller there, Elizabeth Ellis. Who is one of my favorites.
Oh, she's magnificent. Yeah, she's been on the show a couple of times. She is absolutely magnificent. I'm proud to call her a friend. She's not here. She's in the Dallas area, but she's pretty marvelous.
I know she was involved in the Tejas Festival at one
absolutely.
Point.
Yeah.
Hey, Joel, I see that you don't only tell stories, but in your bio here we talked about how you're also a story consultant. Could you tell us what you do as a story consultant?
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a funny thing. I had traveled telling stories a lot, which I've always loved and always enjoyed. But what I began to find is that stories are also tools that can really help people. And I find people doing good work who have a difficult time talking about it. Mm-hmm. I know I was at a party once for Thanksgiving some years ago, and someone came up and said, "Oh my God, you're Joel Benizzi. We were listening to your CD." He said, "We were listening to your CD in the car as we were driving back, and we got stuck in traffic in the snow and on our way back home, Philadelphia." He said, We listened to your CD again and again and again and again about 10 times, and then we finally got home to the driveway, and the CD had just started, and we turned off the car, and the kid said, no, turn it on again. We want to hear it. And we sat there listening again in the driveway. And I said, that's all very nice. I said, but I'm a little embarrassed here. But I said, what do you do? And the guy said, we are kind of a nonprofit, but we're not exactly quite a nonprofit. But we work with CDFI institutions that do community development, financial. And he went on with a whole string of acronyms. And I said, wow, wait a minute. I said, you have the cold, dead fish problem. He said, what's that? I said, it's like if you sold the best sushi in town but put up a sign that said cold, dead fish for sale. He said, that's exactly the problem. He said, people in my industry do fantastic work. What they're doing is they're helping first-time borrowers and minorities. They're changing neighborhoods. They're helping people by giving them loans and giving them access to the financial institution that they wouldn't otherwise get. They do great work. But when you ask them about it, what they do is end up giving you acronyms and numbers and can you help us figure out how to tell stories? So that's led to a whole bunch of different work and organizations, and I look for people doing great work. Mm-hmm. I ask about what they do and help them find sometimes their origin story. That is, how did your organization begin, mm-hmm. or your business? Sometimes impact story. How are these affecting people? Right. Your vision story. What's your vision? And it's really a delight. And I do consulting also over the phone with people.
Sure.
Again, it's always looking for people doing something good.
Right. Now, so as a consultant, you'd know this better than anyone else. Is social media doing any damage to the art of storytelling? Because these days it's just glitzy jokes and videos capturing everybody's attention. Is that honing in on the art of storytelling?
You know, I think exactly the opposite.
Really?
Yeah.
So
and I will say
blessing.
I've heard storytellers complain again and again and again. You know, kids today have an attention span of 3 minutes. It used to be four, but we've gone down to three. And that's if you're lucky. And I think of it, you know, when my daughter was young, she would eat dinner. And I'm like your grandmother, Hank, right? She would eat dinner and say, I'm full, I can't eat another bite. Mm-hmm. And we'd say, and then she would ask the next question, which is, what's for dessert?
Uh-huh.
And we'd say, wait a minute. You just said you're full and can't eat another bite. She said, oh, my food stomach is full, but my dessert stomach is starving. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a little bit the way it is with stories. You take excessive random information and tweets and just all this kind of uncontrolled random stuff that comes to us through social media and everywhere else, mm-hmm. and Facebook, and it you pile in. I think that got stomach it, yeah. is full.
Yes.
But the stomach for meaning and genuine human connection,
mm-hmm.
I think people are starved for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you had an idea. Some ideas about this, right, Dr. Hank?
Well, I did. I agree with Joel to a great extent. I also think that, you know, storytelling, the best stories happen organically. You know, they strengthen connections and friendships. And sometimes on social media, I mean, you know, why bother catching up with a friend you haven't seen in a while if you already know what he's been up to, that sort of stuff.
Mm.
But I can certainly see Joel's point. I really can see him. The only thing I'm thinking about right now is having Joel over for the weekend in order to eat schmaltz and tell stories. That's really what I'm thinking about right now.
Me
That's
too.
Chicken fat, everybody. I just wanted you to know that, yeah.
Great.
You know, you know, when we used to have dinner at home, we had a huge rug below the table, and my grandmother used to, she had to rake the fringes on the rug. Before we even got up to tell you about my life. Can anybody say OCD? Can anybody? Okay, yeah. So,
and if you're truly OCD, you will pronounce it as CDO because that's the letters in alphabetical order.
Right.
Okay. All right. Well, let's get back to some stories here. Time's running fast, so let's get a few more in here.
All right.
Now, Joel, I've noticed that you don't shy away from politics, and recently you posted on your blog a certain parable that you'd like to tell tonight, and it tells a story, and it's very applicable to the political situation, the division we have in this country. Let's hear that story.
Oh, love to. No, I don't shy away from politics. You know, I recently performed. I was back in Ireland, and I walked across England, starting in Newcastle, and went to Israel. So I brought stories to Ireland. In Ireland, I got some coals, which I brought to Newcastle. And then England, I picked up some opinions, which I brought to Israel. It was my redundancy tour. But, you know, just sort of thinking about it, stories are a great way of getting at something indirectly. And this is a story, a parable. It's a Sufi story. The Sufi is the mystic branch of Islam. And it's said that there was a dervish on the side of the road sitting meditating. We think of whirling dervishes, but sometimes a dervish will sit and meditate in a real trance-like state. And as he sat there meditating, along came a prince riding atop an elephant, and followed by all his courtiers. And this prince, who was a bit full of himself to have some fun, he pointed at the dervish sitting on the side of the road, and he took a can that he was holding. And he threw the can at the dervish and hit him right in the back. And the dervish jumped up. He said, "Your Highness, may you have everything you wish for in life, even your greatest dreams, and may you be happy."
Wow.
And then he sat down. Now, someone who'd watched this whole thing came to the dervish and said, "Are you all right?" He said, "Yes, it was just a can." He said, "I have to ask, that prince, for no reason, threw a can at you, he hit you in the back, and you called out this may you have everything you wish for in life. Did you say that because you knew he could not have it and it would be a curse? Or did you say it because you knew if he got it, it would corrupt him and it would destroy him even further?" And the dervish said, "Gentle student, perhaps it has not occurred to you, but if someone had everything they wished for in life, even their greatest hopes, and was truly happy, they would have no need to throw cans at dervishes sitting on the side of the road."
You know, that is so simple, but so logical.
It was an Idris Shah story. Yeah. He has a whole bunch of Sufi stories. And I think this may have been original, but I haven't been able to track it down.
Yeah.
But I think that when we talk about sort of bullies and the people, and I'm not going to mention any politicians by name because they get more than enough coverage, but when we talk about the sort of the bullies that need to put down other people and insult and belittle people, give them names, how sad.
Yes.
For that soul.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm. Okay, in your latest book, Joel, Dreidels on the Brain, which I read and I loved, by the way. You talk extensively about your Jewish upbringing, and it's a hilarious.
Are you Jewish? I didn't know that.
Funny, you don't look Jewish.
There's no signs or anything. I don't know.
Well, Joel, I got to ask you something off script here. When you were writing that book, did you intend it to be kind of a educational book for us non-Jewish guys? Because I learned so much about Hanukkah, Bar Mitzvahs, Shlemiels,
Shlemazels, Nebish. I did, you know. I realized that the joy in talking about these things is in explaining it.
Yeah, I feel like I just took a course in Jewishness or something.
Understand Hank better now?
Yes, it's getting better. But I told my wife, I said, if a guy reads your book and watches Fiddler on the Roof a couple times, mm-hmm. he's very well versed in everything Jewish.
Yeah,
that's exactly true. And you know how that book came about? It's funny because I had told that story. Well, I after The Beggar King came out, a publisher in New York contacted me and said, "I loved it. Would you come see me when you're in New York next time?" And I went and visited her. She was a lovely woman named Lori, and we sat and had hot chocolate in this little cafe. And she said, "So, have you ever thought of a story that you might think of putting in a young adult book?"
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "You know, there is this story that I heard when I was a kid about an orange."
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "An orange? What's that?" And I told her the story. She said, "Oh, I want to publish that in a book."
Mm-hmm.
I said, "You know, well, there's more to it. There's kind of, you know, it's sort of set in a Hanukkah story, and it's set in over 8 days, like about 1971. She said, "Great, write a sample chapter. I'll buy it."
Mm-hmm.
And I could not find the voice. And it took 7 years, and I started writing, and it had this glossy tune, kind of like a child's Hanukkah in Wales. When I look back at the Hanukkahs of my youth and the fading, it just all sounded this wrong, faux nostalgic, and I couldn't get it. And then suddenly, I gave up and said, I'm going to try something completely different. And the whole tone of the book came to me in two words. Mm-hmm. It was like Proust's Madeleine cookie. And suddenly in two words, I saw the whole thing. And it all came together. And the two words became the title of the first chapter.
And?
Which is chopped liver.
I remember.
And the question that I ponder, you know, is what do you call a miracle that doesn't happen? And that's sort of very much within the book. It begins as a sort of a challenge I make to God on this night of Hanukkah, which my life has felt so unmiraculous. My father is sick and might need to go to the hospital again. I'm waiting for it to snow in L.A. We have no snow. It's just smog falling down through the air. And I feel it's just everything's so, so unmiraculous. And I say, God, I want one Hanukkah miracle here. Just one. Give me one and I will believe. And I'm sitting and I had a dreidel. And, of course, a dreidel is a four-sided spinning top. Depending on what letter you get, you win or lose, and the gimel is the one where you win. I said, I'm going to spin this dreidel four times, and all I want is to get four gimels in a row.
Right.
Then I'll believe, and I'm good to go. So I was sitting all alone. I spun the dreidel, and what do you know? Gimel. I said, that's good. That's good. I spun it again and again. Gimel. I said, that's good. Gimel means you win everything. And my family, we'd won nothing. And I tried it a third time. And again, gimel. Mm. And I said, that's pretty good, God, but that's just one out of 64. Mm. Chances of that happening. You get three gimels in a row. And then I instantly felt stupid. Like, why am I explaining God about math? God should know about math. But I'll see if it happens a fourth time. Mm. Then I'll believe. And I spun that dreidel as hard as I could. And it's in the middle of that dreidel spin that the story begins. And it's a story about the miracles you wish for and the ones you actually get. And it's also a story about storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
So I won't say too much about it because I'll let your listeners go out and find the book if they want. Or there's audio of both books.
You're going to leave us spinning, in other words.
That's right. Spinning stories is what I do best.
The fourth dreidel. Yeah, you know, I got to say that in that book, it's hilarious. I know I sound like a film critic here when I say this, but it's laugh-out-loud funny. In fact, my wife is upset with you because I woke her up a few times laughing when I was reading your book.
But
I just wanted to interject here that what I loved about that book is it's so hysterical all the way through, but then all of a sudden there will be these episodes like the one with the orange on the bus that just they're so heart-rending. So you got hysteria and heart-rending. So it's like a multifaceted experience going through that book.
It's kind of like life, you know, as you describe it.
You mentioned chopped liver before. Yeah. I remember that scene in the book. You were at, I think, a bar mitzvah.
Mm.
And there was an image of Richard Nixon carved out of a large piece of chopped liver.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the
sounds
kind of story.
Like something, yeah. That you know, Jewish upbringing is so damn unique. There's no other way to phrase it. You know, can anybody say clinical depression and OCD? Because those are the two byproducts. No, but you know, actually, when I think about my Jewish upbringing on a very serious level, and I'm not really proud of this, and I've had a long talk about this with my mother, as a matter of fact, Joel, and that is that, you know, you're raised not to trust. You're raised not to trust because when you're raised with a family who've been in the Holocaust, like nobody likes you, nobody wants to be around you, everybody's dangerous, and that's what you've learned. But you know, my grandmother was the single funniest person I've ever known. You probably get that idea. There was a real short,
real short episode. When I was 10 years old, we had a Methodist minister living down the street. I don't remember his last name, but his first name was Harvey. And Harvey and my grandmother are talking in the kitchen, drinking tea in a glass. You could only drink tea in a glass. You know, it was impossible to hold, but no one cared. And they were the jelly glasses, you know, from Flintstones. Yeah. So they're drinking tea, and I'm overhearing this. And Harvey is telling my grandmother the story of Jesus. And my grandmother is listening very attentively. She was a great listener. She leaned forward. She nodded her head. She listened carefully. And then after about a 10-minute sermon, he asked her, "Well, Rose, what do you think of all of that?" And she said, "He was an honest boy, but God?" You know, and that was it. So, I don't know. She could just get you to shut up with one vocal cadence. She just had an ability to do that. Yeah. She was a riot. She was funny.
And, you know, I do have to say, and I always say, it's not a Jewish story without a but. But
that's right. But
and I would say, in a way, our history has taught us not to trust. But in a way, we are given something that lets us wrestle with that. You know, Israel means the wrestlers with God.
Right.
We're given not necessarily trust, but a willingness to sort of look and seek and wonder and search for that. And that in a way is maybe better.
You know, I just wanted to tell you that to shift for a moment, getting to us after Eric got a hold of your website. You're just a real gentleman to get a hold of us because you're a famous guy, and to reach out to us, we really appreciate it. And unfortunately, we got to close up in just a moment because we got another guy coming in who actually has a show who thinks is better than this. It's not.
Tell Lars figure. That.
Yeah. Lars, stay there. We need another hour with this guy.
At least
but in any event, we would like you to spend, and again, excuse the parameters, about, you know, 30 seconds giving us some parting words of wisdom about storytelling and about how storytelling soothes our soul.
Well, I will say this, and I'll keep it very short because you got to go on. But I would say I just turned 60 as I was walking across England.
I don't want to hear about it because nobody's older than me. So, yeah.
but I decided when I turned 60, I thought, you know, there are three things in life that are really important to me. One is curiosity, one is generosity, and one is gratitude. And I think those three things are what storytelling is all about: curiosity, generosity, and gratitude.
Well, that's a great thought to end the program with. Thanks, Joel. I think we could talk to you all night.
Hank, what a pleasure talking to you both. I hope to come on again and come
see you. You better believe it. You can bank on it.
Come down here in person if you ever get to Houston.
All right.
Okay. Well, folks, don't you dare move, because Lars is up next with a sweet mix of singer-songwriters on Tennyson's Tape Deck. Be sure to make 90.1 a part of your everyday life. And while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Eric Heen, and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we want you to always remember that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
KPFT makes a difference with real people, real stories, and real voices.
I was put in a room where I was hung by my arms. I was couldn't sit down. I couldn't rest all the time with a bag over my head.
Whether it's hearing music that opens your mind or radio that stirs your soul. You know you can count on KPFT to bring you the stories and the people behind the stories.
The Shock Doctrine.